welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm Robin Buller, your host. Today we will be talking with Dr. Olga Borovaya, who is a visiting scholar at the Taube Center for Jewish Studies at Stanford University. She will be talking with us about her book, The Beginnings of Ladino Literature, Moses Almosnino and His Readers. Olga, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me, Robin, in particular because, as you know, Sephardic studies are really underrepresented everywhere. And I always think about it when I hear the theme music of this show, which is klezmer. So I'm very happy to talk about Sephardic studies here.
It's such a pleasure to have you. I completely agree. And that's part of the reason why I'm so looking forward to our discussion. Before we get into discussing, Ladino literature and Almosnino, I wonder if you could tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and what brought you to Sephardi studies.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. So I have an MA in Romance Languages and Literatures from Moscow State University. So when I got interested in Sephardim, in Ottoman Sephardim, I thought it would be a good idea to look at their literature. And very quickly, I realized that approaching it as most other literatures, like let's say French or English or German literature, and discuss its aesthetic value and analyze the styles and the images and the effects is not going to be productive. Because the Ladino or Judeo-Spanish speech community was very small. At the end of the 19th century, it was probably around 250,000. But really, for most of its history, it was smaller. And given the period, most of the literacy was also very low. So this literature did not, that we can't expect there to find there Joyce or Shakespeare or Molière. It didn't happen that way. But it doesn't make this literature less valuable or less important. It's just that it's a window on the life of Sephardic Jews in the Ottoman Empire. Well, obviously, any literary text or any text is a window on the given literature, on the given culture. But, when you read, let's say, Joyce, you don't read this book in search of facts, historical facts. And in Sephardic studies, as you also know, we have so few archival documents that every bit of information is extremely valuable wherever we find it. And I've been able to find a lot of useful, important information in Ladino sources. Just studying a masthead, the masthead of a newspaper gives us a lot of information. It's just not the price, it's the motto, lots of things, the calendars it uses, but also really facts, historical facts. And quite recently, I've been lucky enough to find a couple of important historical facts in the Ladino text. But that's only one aspect. Of course, because you see, Ladino literature has been probably 95%, it's a didactic literature. And that is why it's always important to understand who is teaching and what they want the audience to learn. And that is what we learn from the text. And that tells us a lot about this community. So when I looked at this, when I realized that, I also realized that in order to do a good job to understand Ladino literature, for what it is, one really has to ask historical questions. You just can't avoid it, not that I wanted to. And I started asking historical questions without being trained as a historian. And I think this is, in my opinion, that is the most productive way of approaching Ladino literature. That is to say, with historical questions in mind and actually in the text itself.
And so with that in mind, what brought you to study Moses Almosnino in particular, and to study his audience?
Oh, yes, that's of course, the key question. Well, first of all, a friend gave me his book. So one book was published in Barcelona, his chronicles. It's called in Spanish, this edition calls it La Cronica de los Reyes Otomanos, that is to say, the Chronicle of Ottoman Kings. And I read this book, and I just loved it. And I read the introduction, and I learned that Moses Hermusnino was very famous and very important. So I was sure I would find a lot of literature about him, dissertations, monographs, articles. But to my great amazement, I found only a couple of articles, and they were all written by linguists. I was really shocked. I couldn't understand what the problem was. But I decided that no matter what, I was going to write about him sometime or translate his work. And in this book, I actually managed to do both, because I have one of the texts, which I find the most interesting. I translate it into English, and the readers may find it in the appendix. But that was my first approach. But then I started thinking why Hermusnino was not included. And I started looking at the histories, at the books on Ladino literature produced in Spain. There are many books. And to my even, I was really astounded to find out that the 16th century Ladino literature is not considered Ladino literature. And then I understood why. And I decided that I really have to fix this, I have to say why it is, explain why it is wrong and why 16th century literature also has to be is part of Ladino literature. But there was a third consideration, which is, it's a little complicated, but I find it, and it's probably very ambitious, but I find it extremely important. So in the past 20 centuries, in the past 20 years, looking back, we can say that now there is a Stanford School in Sephardic studies. It was founded, if we may use this big word, it was by Aaron Rodrigue, who wrote foundational works on Sephardic history. And when I say Sephardi here, I always mean the Ottoman Jews, Judeo-speaking Jews. And then he had, in the past 20 years, he had six students. One of them is still to write his dissertation, but we know he will. And he already had some of the scholars on the show. And usually talking about the school, one talks about a new method. I can say there's a new method, but what happened is that this group of people normalized the field of Sephardic studies, which until then was actually sort of ethnic studies, quote unquote. All the scholars, including Aaron Rodrigue, work on the 19th and 20th centuries. And as I said, there's no new method. But what is new is the application of methods used by general historians, applying it to Sephardic history. This is something new. It hadn't been done before. So now it's just a regular field of history. And by the way, half of us are not even Sephardi. So it's never self-referential. We're really interested in the history of Sephardi in Sephardic culture. So how is this related to Moses Hermusnino? Spain certainly has its own school of literary studies of Ladino. The school that studies Ladino literature, but they don't ask historical questions. They do a lot of useful things, but it's different from what is done in the United States in this Stanford School. And because it's such a new thing, normalization of Sephardic studies, many of us have to debunk myths or correct various misconceptions. And I felt very strongly that we also have to say something about the history of Ladino literature, because I so much disagreed with what my Spanish colleagues did. So I thought, since I'm the only literary scholar in this group, I thought it's my obligation, it's my duty, to chart the territory, to remap it. And I've never had the intention of writing a history of Ladino literature as a whole, but because in my first book, I dealt with the 19th, 20th century, I decided to go back to the 16th century and write about Moses and Musnino so that other scholars, I'm sure, will do a very good job writing the history of Ladino literature in other periods. So that is why Al Musnino became so important for me. And for many years, I've been collecting materials so that at some point when I was done with my first book, I would be able to write a book about him and the beginnings of Ladino literature.
So studying Al Musnino and his contemporaries is sort of, you would say, a really important foundational step for understanding modern Ladino culture.
I think it's a step for understanding Ladino culture in general. And I think because, as I mentioned earlier, that Sephardic studies are underrepresented and people don't know enough, I felt that we need to say more about different things and to make our field, again, more normal. And hopefully there will be other people who will not necessarily do history, they will do literature or sociology. So I sort of wanted to chart this big territory.
And so on that point of Sephardi studies being so underrepresented, you and I have been sort of throwing around this word Ladino. Some of our listeners might not be very familiar with what Ladino is. I wonder if you could give us a bit of background information on the history of Ladino as a language and, you know, how this vernacular developed.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I should have started with it. First of all, Ladino, well, it's never too late. Ladino is the same thing as Judeo-Spanish. This is an Iberian, it's an Iberian Romance language, which emerged in the 16th century, and its grammar is essentially that of Castilian Spanish in the 15th century, but its syntax has been heavily influenced by other languages, mainly by Hebrew, and later in the 19th century by French. Hmm. And its vocabulary has a certain number of Hebrew words and Aramaic words, but not too many, actually. But it has many Turkish, Italian, Portuguese, sometimes Greek, sometimes Slavic words, depending on the territory. Mm. There are lots of debates around Ladino, what it should be called, what Ladino was. And I don't want to get into this because it's so boring, really. But your question, it is boring because so much has been written about. I've written about myself in my first book, so I'm not interested. But it's actually very important. But what is important is the history of Ladino, when it emerged. So the main reason 16th century Ladino literature is not considered Ladino literature by my Spanish colleagues is that they believe that Ladino, or they call it Judeo-Spanish, fully received, reached its more or less final shape in the 18th century. Therefore, everything written before does not count as Ladino literature. Well, that is a very strange idea, right? Because nobody starts writing the history of Castilian literature from Cervantes. We start from El Cantar de Mio Cid, which is around 1200, and it's not even Castilian. It's a different variety, and nobody questions this. So why would we wait till the language reaches its final shape, quote unquote, in order to start studying the literature produced in this language? So what these people say, they say, it's actually an extension of Castilian literature, implying that lets scholars of Castilian literature study it, but that makes no sense. Well, this literature emerged outside the Iberian Peninsula. It was written by Jewish authors specifically for a Jewish audience. And we know this because it was written in Hebrew characters. So Spanish scholars not interested in Sephardi culture may not even know it exists. And even if they do, why would they be interested? They may be interested, but it's really not part of their culture. So it's very strange to assume that they should deal with that. But probably an even more important issue is that it's clear, I mean, sociologically, it's obvious that once the Sephardi, significant Sephardi population moves to the Ottoman lands, it starts producing texts. And from this moment on, the vernacular they use starts a different route. It becomes, and with every year, clearly in every century, it becomes more and more different from Castilian, which is normal. However, this march starts in the early 16th century. So why should we really just throw it out and say it doesn't count? There's another consideration that Ladino literature is supposed to be, it's, you know, popular culture, mass literature. How can it be high culture literature, which is what Al-Muzayyano is, right? So why should we consider it Ladino literature? Well, so Ladino literature was not always this way. In the 16th century, there were three different registers of Ladino literature, in Ladino literature, three functional styles. And that's what I proposed. There were three different functional styles, two of which disappeared with time, and only one survived. This is the style that was later used in rabbinic and then in mass literature in the 19th century. And the reason they disappeared is because there was no longer an audience for them. And so it's just a normal literary process, normal dynamics, which we want to follow and to study, but not just throw it away and say it's none of our business. And also they believe that we should start in the 1730, and then it immediately becomes the golden age of Ladino literature. Now, why is that? Well, because someone said that in the early 20th century, but literature does not start with its golden age, right? And also, who says it's golden? I think that the 19th century is the golden age, because that's when we have both secular and religious literature, and we have lots of different genres and a huge output. And we don't see that in the 18th century. So as you see, I really was very motivated to say what I thought about Ladino literature. And I felt the need to really, so to speak, move its border, because it really starts, because the community was actually important. It was produced, this corpus of text was produced by one speech community in one territory in a language which it considers to be the same, even in the 20th century. And let's say Yiddish literature, it starts in the 13th century and is produced in different territories, and it went through a very complex development, and nobody questions it. Nobody says, okay, it only started in the 19th century. So that is why Al-Muzayyano was not included, and it was not just Al-Muzayyano. There were two more authors who wrote in the same literary style or register, and there were different other texts, which are not included either.
So the question is really one of periodization, and in some ways, these subjective decisions to make the period later that have been.
Exactly, and exactly right. And that is why periodization, once you start 2 centuries early, you certainly need a new periodization. And of course, one can, you know, periodization can be based on lots of different criteria. And I suggest for Ladino literature, which, as I said before, is really mainly didactic, I suggest a different approach. I believe that one can, it's useful to talk about three educational projects. The goal of the first project was to introduce the ex-conversos to normative Judaism. So there were many people who were forcefully or sometimes almost voluntarily converted to Christianity. And some of them remained in Europe. And they, we call them actually crypto Jews, because in their own way, they observed, they considered themselves Jews and did something, if only not working on Shabbat. And these people, while they were in Europe, of course, they did not know Hebrew. And then they decided to go to the Ottoman Empire, where they returned, as they say, or actually embraced Judaism, because many of them had never been Jews, technically speaking. And these people did not know Hebrew. So the idea was to teach them normative Judaism, but in language that they didn't, language that they did understand. But since no Latin characters were not used, it had to be done in Hebrew script. And besides, what made this audience different is that those people were mainly really educated people. Many of them graduated from European universities, but they did not know much or anything about Judaism. So that's a unique period in Jewish history, because this is this period when one could be called an educated Jew and yet not know Hebrew. So they were educated people, but not educated as Jews. So that was the purpose of the first educational project. But once mass immigration and conversion immigration came to an end, this project lost its relevance. In the 18th century, the rabbis decided that in a wake of the Sabbatean crisis, when Shabtai Tzvi, Sephardic Jew from Izmir, proclaimed himself in 1666, he proclaimed himself the Messiah. And that, and he had a lot of followers. So that certainly turned to, certainly led to a crisis. And though not directly, but the project of 18th century Sephardic Jews was to teach the masses, they call them the ignorant masses, which includes both men and women and people of all ages, to teach them Judaism in a language that they understood, because of course they didn't know Hebrew. And the 19th century is, in the 19th century, we see the third educational project, but it overlapped with the second one. That's why I prefer to talk about different educational projects rather than, excuse me, about time periods, because it starts in the mid 19th century. And, you know, the name of this project is Westernization. That is to say, European-style education as the universal remedy. So they overlapped with the rabbinic project, although, of course, the secular literature took over. I find it a useful analytic tool, but certainly this is not the only one. And because we talk about different educational projects, we talk about the audiences. So to answer your question, yes, because each project has its, had its own target audience.
Great. So I'll move us back to the specific character that sort of guides your study in this book. Who was Moses Amos Nino? And, you know, what do we know about him? What don't we know about him?
Well, in a strange way, we don't know much about him. So Moses Amos Nino was a rabbi. We're not sure about his the date of his birth and the date of his death. But we believe that he was born in 1518 in Salonika and died probably in 1580, probably in Istanbul. And we don't know why he died or where he's buried. We know a little bit about his family. What's important is that his parents came from Aragon, where his grandparents were very much involved in helping conversos to go, to really to return to Judaism. And he was a very educated person. He knew many languages. Clearly, he knew a few European languages. And of course, he knew Greek, Latin, surely Italian. Most likely, he also knew Arabic. He knew some Turkish, some vernacular Turkish, so he could speak a little bit. Excuse me, I need a sip of water. So he also was a leader, one of the leaders of Salonika community, and he was famously sent to Istanbul to deal with the tax problem that Salonikan Jews had to face. He was highly respected. He preached in several synagogues in his city. And what is probably more relevant, he was close, very close with many ex-conversos who just came through Europe, but they mainly came from Portugal. He was the rabbi of this new Portuguese synagogue, which was founded by Dona Gracia Nassi, this is a very famous woman. She was also from Portugal, and she got very rich, and the Sultan Suleiman helped her get to the Ottoman Empire from Italy, where she was persecuted by Inquisition. And so she made a huge contribution, I mean, financial contribution to the education of the conversos, of ex-conversos. And her brother, Joseph Nassi, he became the Prince Salim's, he was his courtier or sometimes advisor. And when Salim became Sultan Salim II, he continued, he still had close relations with Joseph Nassi. And Al-Muznini knew Nassi personally. We could probably say that they were friends. And so this is how Al-Muznini met many rich, educated conversos, ex-conversos, who most of whom live in Istanbul. We know that he traveled to Istanbul several times, and he met many people. And he knew very well what was going on. Well, what was going on in the court, of course, in the part that concerned Ottoman Jews. So there were a few Jews close to the court, and so they were an important source of information for him. As for his work, it was known and was highly respected, both in Europe and in the Ottoman Empire, which does not mean, actually, that it was really known in the Ottoman Empire, except for one text, the Regimiento de la Vida, the Regiment of Living, which is a didactic treatise which he wrote, presumably at his nephew's request, but it was meant for all young people. And it was written in Ladino and had a Ladino Hebrew glossary, which is quite unusual. It was it was published in Amsterdam in 1729. It was rearranged, adapted, and it was printed in Latin characters. And his other treatise, the treatise on the dreams, was also reprinted, was also published in Amsterdam, and he was considered a highly important scholar. As for his other very well-known work, which I will call here the Chronica, or La Cronica de los Reyes Otomanos, which is not his own title, it was given to it by Pilar Romeo, who published it, so we'll just call it La Cronica or the Chronicle. It was published, in a very it appeared in the 17th century in Madrid, but it was not only printed in Latin characters, but it was completely rearranged. The parts of this book were changed places, and one of them, the most Jewish one, was just deleted and wouldn't have been interesting for the audience. So these sources were, these texts were known, and then the Chronicle was used in the 19th century as a source on the history, on Ottoman history. And then we see mentions of his name in the 19th and early 20th century, but really, Ottoman Jews didn't really know his work. Although probably his Hebrew work was better known, but it was known by rabbis. But his name, we hear every time, every period, we hear his name from important scholars or authors who have to say something about him.
So even though his name is mentioned in all of these important works, you know, over the following centuries, as you've mentioned, he hasn't received really any scholarly attention in the modern period. Is that case just, again, bringing us back to this question of periodization, that he isn't considered part of this, you know, Ladino corpus, or is there something else to it?
Well, it's the Spanish scholars who don't consider him part of the corpus. It's something else. And this is relevant to what we've been talking about. He wrote in this high register. He wrote for an educated audience. And this audience disappeared with the end of the ex-converso immigration. And so later, to read his books, one needed to be really educated. Know, be familiar with philosophy, be familiar with sort of what was called sciences then. And this was not the kind of popular knowledge that one can expect. So he was simply not, it was too difficult. And so Hooley, the person who is considered the greatest author of the greatest Sephardi author, and I have to disagree with that, although he was certainly very important. He started the famous Bible commentary, popular Bible commentary, Me'amnoez, the first volume of which came out in 1730, which is why my Spanish colleagues consider this the beginning of Ladino literature. This was a Bible commentary for the masses. But he, in the introduction, he had to go to great length to explain and apologize why he was not using Al-Muzni's work. He had to explain that it was not readable. So, of course, scholars knew his work, but he had, and of course, we're only talking about his regimen of living, because the Chronicle was never published. You know, secular literature was not popular. It was not printed in the 16th century. It survived the manuscript.
I see. Okay, so this discussion of then audience actually segues into my next question nicely, which is that you use Al-Musnino's writings in this sort of fascinating and unusual way that you mentioned at the beginning, which is to get a sense of, you know, who his readers were, his intended and his unintended readers. I'm curious, during your research process, you know, what sort of questions did you ask yourself in order to get to the bottom of these questions? What were your methods when approaching his work?
Well, my favorite method is close reading. But of course, sometimes I need to do other things. And in this case, because it was clearly an educational project, I needed to ask historical questions. Why did this literature emerge? Why did these three Sephardi authors produced those texts, why there was Ladino literature in two other registers produced in the 16th century. Those were translations of the Bible and different instructions written for Sephardim who did not know Hebrew. I had to ask, why was there this need? Why was there, clearly there were more than one audience. Why? Who were these people who needed these books? And then more importantly, because it's more, seems to be more mysterious, why did this audience disappear? So these are purely historical questions, but also looking at the text themselves, of course, I look for lots of different things. I wanted to know what Al-Musnino read, and it's generally believed that he read European literature, which was still available to those who knew the Latin alphabet. But I was able to figure out which books he probably read, going to the quotations and rather allusions and the word usage. And also, I looked at what kind of knowledge he expected from his readers and what he wanted them to believe. And I must say that different texts had different messages. Not like he always wanted, you know, to hammer the same thing. No, he wasn't like that. And of course, I also looked for, I want to explain why he used certain genres and not other genres and what models he was using. So those were questions about him, but he was a member of his own class. So this was a question about his class and also about his readership. And once I've been able to explain it to myself, then it became clearer, much clearer, what happened later. And that is why it's so important to, I mean, I don't even understand how one cannot study this period of Latino literature.
And so what then are some of these, you know, some of these genres and models that he produced? I mean, you mentioned the earlier treatises, but what sorts of written material did he produce that then you focus specifically on in this book?
Yeah, well, that's, of course, also a very important question. I would say that he worked in three different genres, though he was never very consistent anywhere. So the first genre, which may be less exciting for the modern reader, but of course it's important, he created the genre of the Ladino scholarly Ladino epistle. It sounds strange because there was before the expulsion, there were scholarly epistles written by Jewish scholars, but of course only in Hebrew, because that was the language of high culture and the language of scholarship. But his readers did not know Hebrew. He was very familiar with the epistolography of Spanish Christians. Now, but they were talking to a Christian audience. And there were also letters written by Iberian Jews in the vernacular addressed to important figures, politicians and monarchs, Christian monarchs in the peninsula. So they were written in the vernacular, and some of them were scholarly epistles, but they also were an answer to a question, and they were supposed to be answered. So that was an exchange. What Al-Muslimi had to do was to write about scholarly subjects to those people who were educated, including these subjects, but they did not know Hebrew. So it had to be, he had to use a high register because he could not write in the everyday style. It would have been totally inappropriate. But it's even more important how this genre emerged. These people who came from Europe asked him questions. Sometimes they were related to Judaism and to spiritual matters. There are two Ladino treatises, which unfortunately have not survived, and he mentions them. One was a letter on the soul, and the other, the letter on the resurrection of the dead. So he even talked about this theological issues in the vernacular, something unheard of until then. He was really, so he did something totally new. He wrote, and some of these epistles were short, and they were just technical instructions, like to use a silver clog that he constructed, or how to use the astrolabe. But of course, he would also go into in the works of Greek scholars and would provide a lot of information which required the addressee to know what he was talking about. And he used, of course, bookish words. And because he had to borrow them from Castilian literature. And his most famous treatise, which I mentioned before, The Regimen of Living, El Regimiento de la Vida, as I said, was written at the request of his nephew. And his other treatise, the treatise on dreams, was written on the request of Don Joseph Nassi, whom I mentioned before. So he asked Al-Muzmina what he thought about dreams. They had conversation. And so Al-Muzmina decided to write a treatise on the subject. He wrote six treatises, but only four of them survived. That was the first genre. And it really, it's totally different. And I think this is the genre where he really created this high style or register of Ladino language. Do you want me to talk about the other genres as well?
Yes, I was going to ask actually. So what are the other two styles?
Yeah, the other two styles. So there are styles and there are genres. So there are this a second
okay, so
style.
The other two...
Yeah, I'm glad to talk about both. So there was a style.
And just to clarify, styles are subsets of genres.
No, styles
is that
are
correct?
No, they're language styles. They're register language.
Got it.
Register.
Oh, right, the register.
Yes.
Okay.
And
I
so
see. Thanks for
we're talking sure. And we're talking about the high register of Ladino, of the Ladino language. The second one was what some scholars call Ladino cock or just Ladino. That is a very strange register or functional style. It was born, actually only existed in one form. When the Bible was translated into Ladino, it was considered important to translate it literally, word by word, and even keeping all the syntactic cocks. So it didn't use any Hebrew words, but was really unreadable. For those people who did not know Hebrew, it was really unreadable. But this style existed and was believed that was the only way to translate the Bible, because you can't translate it in the everyday vernacular. That's what they thought in the 16th century. So one was supposed to read this and assume that one is familiar with the Bible, that one studies the Bible this way, even though I can't understand how anybody would make sense of this. And this functional style disappeared in the 18th century when the rabbis decided to write in a language that people would really understand, which was revolutionary. And the third style was, or register, was closer to the spoken Ladino. That was the language of the instructions given to, let's say, to women or to men, what they were supposed to do, religious instructions. I mean, technical instructions. How do you prepare for Shabbat? What do you do? What do you put on? What do you do before the prayer or after the prayer? And it used many Hebrew words and also syntactic cocks. From Hebrew, and we do have a little some idea of the spoken language actually, because there are these testimonies in the responses. Now, in Sephardi culture, Sephardi tradition, responses, the responsive word answers to the questions asked by people, different people. They ask the rabbis for legal decisions and legal answers. And they included testimonies of different people. And usually in the Sephardic tradition, they were not translated into Hebrew. Of course, they were edited. But still, it does give us an idea of what was the language of the everyday communication. So now let's go back. So now we see different styles or functional styles or registers. That's language. Now we'll go back to our literary genres. So the genres were, so Al-Muznin Rouveau produced three literary genres. The first one was the epistles, the scholarly epistles, for the first time written in the vernacular. The second genre was the chronicle. The chronicle, of course, yes. So the chronicle, well, he calls them chronicles, but we can't really... Well, so this is, it gets more complicated. So when Al-Muznin, as I said, he was sent as a member of a delegation from Salonika to deal with the tax problems in Istanbul. And that was because he had these close connections with Joseph Nasi, who in turn was very close with the prince, Prince Selim. That was right before Suleiman's death in 1566. When Suleiman died, then Selim said, Joseph Nasi said that Selim was going to settle all their problems. But first there was the funeral, then there was coronation, there was always something why the new sultan was busy. And then, this Ottoman court known for its bureaucracy and corruption. So it took a lot of time. And all this time, starting in June 66, and it continued through September 67, Al-Muznin Rouveau. Actually, he returned to Salonika even in January of 68. But this time, before November, which was the time of Suleiman's funeral, November 1566, and April and September 1567, al-Muznino produced his really famous chronicle. And this chronicle consists of four completely different texts. And the first chronicle was written, it was about the death and described the death and the funeral of Suleiman the Magnificent. But he, yes, it doesn't, but what is very interesting, what's most important, why did al-Muznino write it? What was the idea? So he tells us clearly that he was asked by some friends who were close to the court to write this chronicle. And that then we hear from time to time, he mentions that he got his information from very competent sources, very reliable sources. Obviously, most of the time it was Joseph Nassi, also maybe the doctors, Jewish physicians who he also knew. And he talks about the death, which he never witnessed, of course, and he only saw part of the funeral. And why this text was so important for those who commissioned him? Because they had this idea that they needed to. The general idea was to recreate the royal alliance that they had in the Iberian Peninsula when the Jews had direct connection to the royalty, to the kings, and they paid taxes or whatever they paid directly. There was direct connection. There was no intermediaries, and that made their life easier and gave them more influence. And that's what they wanted to create in the Ottoman Empire. And so they believed that it was important to educate those ex-conversos who were educated and mobile, socially mobile people. You know, they went from, you know, came all the way from Europe, and many of them were well off. They had connections outside the Ottoman Empire, which was useful for trade. So Joseph Nassi and his circle believed that would be important to teach people that Ottoman Empire is such a wonderful place for them to be, and they should really collaborate, that they should work with the authorities to create to strengthen this alliance and serve the Ottoman Empire, which would secure to the Jewish community a comfortable position. And that is why, of course, the text that al-Muznino created, it was a chronicle, but it was very much influenced by what they told him. And so you can't call it an accurate description, although it's very interesting to read. It's actually fun reading. It's really nice. But it's also important for historians. And one has to be very careful with the facts we find in his book. So that was the first chronicle. Yes, it was. But I think the first chronicle was less propagandistic than the second one. And I actually call al-Muznino the first Jewish political author in the Ottoman Empire. So the second chronicle, so the first chronicle was written in 48 hours. So I suppose he received all the necessary information. And so he was ready to write. They did the research for him. Yeah, right. I suppose they gave him, okay, this is what you need to write. This is what you need to put in here. And the second chronicle was written in April 1567 during the Bayram holidays, when the court, they couldn't deal with the court at all because of the holidays. So he had time to write. And of course, al-Muznino always said that he was too busy doing other more important things. So he found time to write, and he had a few weeks then, and he wrote a chronicle which was twice longer than the first one, and that was really propagandistic. So this chronicle is a history of Suleiman's rule. He talks about all his wars and victories, all the victories. He talks about his viziers, the ministers, about the judges, the ulema, the clergy, and He talked about Suleiman's architectural patronage, which was very important for Suleiman himself. And he actually set an example for his family and courtiers to start patronizing architectural construction in Istanbul and outside. And Al-Musnad has a whole section, actually very interesting, about these three constructions built by Suleiman's architect Sinan, a very famous architect. And he talks about every one of these three constructions very competently. And it's interesting that today we appreciate the importance of this architectural work. But it really amazes me that Al-Musnad, he came from Salonika, which could not boast any such buildings, he was able to appreciate the importance of these buildings. And of course, he also uses them for propagandistic purposes. See that Suleiman really wanted to help his people. So they built the bridge, but he was unhappy because he thought the bridge was not strong enough, and he made them redo it so that the future generations would be safe using this bridge. It's interesting, it's a combination of real admiration, but also propaganda. So he talks about, but the most important, in terms of the message, the most important part of this, actually the colophon of this book, Al-Musnad talks at length about how Suleiman murdered, or not with his own hands, of course, his sons. That was not unusual. Well, until then, fratricide actually was legitimate. So when someone became the Sultan, he would kill his brothers to avoid a competition. It was sort of a laudable thing to do. And Suleiman actually killed his children, except for one. And it was, it's blood-curdling to read all these things. Horribly cruel, and of course Europeans were totally disgusted, and you would think that the Jews would not appreciate someone killing his children. But it's quite amazing that Al-Musnad says, yes, he killed them, he could have saved them, but he didn't. And the reason he didn't, his main goal was providing stability and security for the empire. And so we are very happy that we have such a wonderful sultan, or had this wonderful sultan, who murdered his own flesh and blood, so that we would have a wonderful, safe, and secure life. And clearly, we need to be grateful for that. Yes, it's really horrible. And it's totally counterintuitive. Yes. It's just really awful. That's not what, Jewish father is supposed to applaud, right? But that's really scary. And of course, it's also interesting that stability and security are valued more than any kind of freedom, which, sounds familiar. So, Al-Musnad says we have to be grateful. We need to work together. We need to help. We need to support these wonderful sultans, so that our community will flourish and thrive, and we will be happy in this empire. And these chronicles, the first one is more or less chronicle. The second one uses different genre features. The part about the architecture, that's totally typically, this travelogue thing. So he describes every monument and the anecdotes related to it. But every anecdote, of course, illustrates Suleiman's wisdom and his love for his people. There are other parts that make one think, and we can't help thinking about the Hebrew chronicles of Ottoman kings written by his contemporaries. But those chronicles, they interpret history only in biblical terms. So this sultan is good because he helps, he brings closer the Messiah, or makes the redemption happen very, very soon in our own lifetime. But Al-Musnad is not interested in that. That is really, I can't say it's a scientific history, but it's certainly a secular history, whether we agree with it or not. So that's the second chronicle. Now, the fourth chronicle, which I did not examine because it's really very different and it's not part of what I was interested in, it describes day by day the life, the existence of the Sephard, of this Salonika delegation in Istanbul, day by day, how they went to the court and what they were told and what they did and whom they met. It's very interesting. It's a very interesting source on Sephardi and actually on Ottoman history, but that was not part of what I was interested in. So I sometimes quoted and cited, but I didn't really analyze it.
And just because we're running a little bit low on time, I wonder if we could move on to discussing, you know, how Amos Nino's work sort of was continued to be reinterpreted and have different audiences and different receptions over the following centuries. So you talk about, you know, the first period of Ladino literature declining. What causes Ladino literature to reemerge, and how is Amos Nino, you know, how does he fit into the next period of Ladino literature?
Yes, I realize I have to be quick. So there are two very important things that I need to explain here. So what happened at the end of the 16th, at the turn of the 17th century? There's nothing, not a single book, Ladino book from the 17th century reached us. Why? What happened? And usually until now, even, you know, people said, well, you know, economic decline. But that's not an explanation, because at the in the end of the 19th century, which I call the golden age of Ladino literature, you know, the empire was nearing a collapse. So, you know, it just doesn't explain it. What I think really explains it is the end of the Converso immigration. And this happened because many European countries began to allow Jews, and that was because they were interested in their trade connections. So Jews found homes in Amsterdam, in Italian cities, and they had no reason to go to the Ottoman Empire with its slow economy. So that was the end of the immigration. And since that was the end, there was no more need. The last book meant for an educated audience was published in 1601. That was a medical treatise. So there was no need to educate or re-educate these educated people. And of course, there were still, you know, regular people who needed to be educated. But there were texts already published in the 16th century. There were quite a bit of them. And then quite a few of them. And many of them were reprinted in Venice. So they were available. And Venice, you know, the connection between Salonika and Venice and Istanbul and Venice were close. So getting books from there was never a problem. They always traveled back and forth. And it's also true that the economic decline in the early 17th century, and particularly, it was particularly important for Salonika. And so many people immigrated from Salonika, and they went to different parts of the Ottoman Empire. So there was not much money for printing, and the Jewish philanthropy did not focus on book printing anymore. And even the rabbis began to be taxed, which never happened before, because, you know, the authorities wanted to get money. So for this very long period, there's nothing printed in Ladino. And I think this hiatus is, to me, now it's pretty clear. So then the question is why it reemerged in the 18th century. And I talked about it before, that this happened in relation, but not in direct connection with the Sabbatean crisis, when the rabbis, Matthias Lehmann called them nicely vernacular rabbis, because they wrote in the vernacular. They decided to educate the masses, the ignorant masses, and they published a considerable number of really important books in the 18th century. They continued in the 19th century, though with less success. And then these audiences, they needed, as I show, it wasn't just this religious literature. Now, clearly, some European novels were also accessible, but only in manuscript. And of course, they didn't survive. I think there's just one fragment, because they were not saved in the Genesis, of course. And in the but when in the 19th century, with Westernization and the introduction of the Alliance Française, Alliance Israélite Universelle, a French philanthropic organization which started, which built a huge, a big number of schools in the East and educated a significant number of students who also taught, who taught French, not formally taught, not never taught Latin, taught Latino, which was mainly banned in most schools. They taught them French. And Westernization, you would think that Al-Muznino would not be relevant anymore because that was the, had nothing to do with that. But actually, what happens is that Al-Muznino became important for the intellectuals again for a very strange reason. They wanted to, when Salonika went through all its hardships in the 20th century in particular, although it started a little early, they wanted to prove that Sephardic Jews were Europeans. And how do you prove it? Well, because Al-Muznino, they believed, wrote in pure Castilian. But unlike modern scholars, it was the same language. They continued speaking it, but they thought that they sort of, you know, corrupted the language. And he wrote it, and they connected him. Not so. Usually, people would say that Al-Muznino, you know, he was he had a strong connection to those Hebrew authors like Ibn Gabirol or Maimonides, but that was about his Hebrew works. As for his Ladino works, somehow they were related to the Spanish Renaissance, when there were no Jews, as a matter of fact. And so this made Sephardic Jews Europeans. And they did not, and that is because Sephardim, like I'm today, they felt bad because they were not considered real Jews, quote unquote, and they were considered those ignorant Orientals who didn't know anything, and they wanted to, you know, reclaim their past glory. So they didn't really, they did not really know his work, but he knew it existed, and some scholars did look at it, but really very few people saw it. As for the interpretation, or rather misinterpretation, of Al-Muznino's work, I think the best example is his travelogue, which is the third part of the Chronica. This is the book that I translated. This book has been, until it was considered a standard travelogue. It was a travelogue of Istanbul. It was considered to be, he was described as very accurate and careful, very attentive observer, and that his descriptions were very accurate and careful, and also his account was called picturesque. And I looked at this text and I thought, what a strange text. It consists of 26 little pieces, each of which starts by saying something in Istanbul exists in two extremes. Let's say it's either too hot or too cold. It's either too expensive or too cheap. Either everybody is sick or nobody has a headache in the whole city. And I thought, how could one take it serious as a travelogue? And scholars used it as a source. And I couldn't believe it. I was just surprised. And I'm ashamed to say that it took me a few years to figure it out. I should have guessed it earlier. What it really is the extension of his Regimiento de la Vida, the Regimen of Living, which is totally based on Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. So what this is, he applies the idea of extremes without a mean to what it cannot be applied. So to climate, to food, to economy, to trade, lots of things for which it makes no sense because it's not a moral. It doesn't, these extremes have nothing to do with moral decisions. Now, when he talks about friendship or generosity, it all comes, it's really quotes from Aristotle. One can learn from that just to decide that one needs to become more generous and being, you know, like Aristotle, he says, we need to form habits. And if we form moral habits, we'll become moral people. But what does it mean when he says that the coins in Istanbul are either very good or very bad? Makes no sense. It's not even established as a fact. It's not true. Or he will say, when there's a lot of food, it's very cheap. It's very expensive because everyone wants to eat it. And when it's very little, it's very cheap. Makes no sense at all. Why didn't anybody get surprised? I was very surprised. And so I was very happy when I was able to figure out that it starts with Aristotelian extremes. But of course, there are allusions and almost quotations from other scholars such as Hippocrates, Maimonides, Ibn Sina, Galen, and medieval health treatises. So he's extremely interesting, very interesting author. And I hope that someone translates the whole book. It's really fun reading, and I can say this about, I love Latino literature, but in good faith, I can say it's all fun reading, but this book is really fun reading.
This has been such a fascinating discussion, and it's such an understudied subject. It's wonderful to hear about it. But before we let you go, I want to hear about what you're working on next, you know, if not this massive translation, what your next project is.
Well, actually, I'm 2/3 into my new project, and don't let me talk about it too much because we really run out of time. But I'm working on something completely different. That's a purely historical project. So I'm working on the blood libel in Rhodes in 1840. It was completely overshadowed by the well-known or infamous blood libel in Damascus in 1840. And people just assume it's the same thing, and that's even symptomatic. I don't think there's any connection between the two. It's completely different. And I found a significant number of very interesting sources. And there are Ladino sources, which have not been seen before. And these sources, I mean, the songs, they really tell us a different story. And I found important facts that even Ottoman sources did not have. So I very much look forward to finishing it. And of course, it will also include the translation of these Ladino sources. So I'm very excited.
That sounds really interesting. That's something that I don't know anything about. So I look forward to having you back on the show once you finish that project.
Well, I hope that's soon.
Yeah, me too.
Give me a deadline anyway.
There you go. Olga, it's been such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you for sharing your book and your time with us. This has been great.
Well, thank you so much, Robin. I'm always happy to talk about Latino literature, so I was very happy that I had this wonderful opportunity. Thank you.
That was Olga Borovaya talking about her book, The Beginnings of Ladino Literature, Moses Almos Nino and His Readers, which is available now through Indiana University Press. This has been New Books in Jewish Studies, which is part of the New Books Network. Thanks for listening.